Who are my neighbors? Tune in to Out There to meet some of them. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5 in the afternoon with me, Ruthie Woodring. Come with me and my recorder to meet people and plants and think about ways we can share the world. That's Out There every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton. Archived editions of Out There are online at weatherbeard.com/RUTHY. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in. That's Now, and today's show is guest produced by my friend John McGee. John is an activist concerned with social justice and agriculture. This is his first podcast, and it's been done with support of Northampton Community Television.
These days, local is the buzzword in food and farming. Supporters of local farms urge us to keep our dollars close to home, where we can be sure we're supporting farms that are socially and environmentally responsible. And when we think of local farms, we might think of quaint farm stands on the edge of sprawling fields. Maybe a lively farmer's market full of beautiful produce and smiling faces. But are we getting the whole picture? When we imagine how this beautiful produce is grown, who do we think does the work? And when we support local farmers, are we supporting their workers too? My name is John McGee, and you're listening to Liberation Agriculture. We'll be discussing these and other questions with my guest, Margaret Gray, Associate Professor of Political Science at Adelphi University and author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic, published in 2014 by UC Press. Margaret, your research has looked at farm labor conditions in the Hudson Valley in New York. Before we talk about what you found, let's set the frame. What sort of farms were you looking at, and how did they fit into the local farm movement in the region?
I specifically wanted to look at farms that had a seasonal or migrant workforce. So that meant fruits and vegetables, because those workers aren't year-round, and you need more workers during the harvest. Compared to, say, a dairy farm where you have year-round workers. So in the literature, you often read about how it's the seasonal workers who are the most vulnerable. So that's why I targeted those farms. And it was a really interesting mix of farms that were part of the local food movement, because not all of them were selling at farmers markets. A fair number were. But what I discovered, and I actually don't think it's my discovery, but that there's usually a regional labor market and regional labor practices. So even though I would be looking at farms that were, one might be selling only to farmers markets and the other only selling wholesale apples, their labor practices were very similar. And I think it was more about regional similarities. I also was looking at what we would probably call more traditional farms. So only two of the farms were organic. Some of them were engaging in integrated pest management to reduce pesticides use. But a lot of them were farms that had been in the family for at least two generations. And the current generation was really trying to understand how to remarket for a local market and to take advantage of that.
What sort of size range were these farms, both in terms of like labor force and in terms of acreage?
So varies a great deal. The, as you're aware, you could have just a couple of acres growing baby arugula rather intensely, or you could have an apple orchard spread out over 200 acres. So the nature of the Hudson Valley prevents really large-scale farms because of the hilly terrain and also because of settlement patterns back when people were first starting to live in the Hudson Valley. But the farm workforce varied from farms with, say, two workers to, I think the largest farm had 80 workers. So a real variety in there. And in terms of acreage, probably 100 to 200. But like some of them were expanding and either leasing or buying up smaller parcels nearby.
How many farms total did you study?
I interviewed workers on 19 farms. I had visited, I think, 32 farms initially to meet workers and talk to workers. And either on the farms that I did not return to for interviews, it was largely because the workforce was leaving for the season, or maybe there weren't any workers on the farm. So 19 farms where I interviewed workers. And then I also interviewed 14 farmers, but maybe a handful overlapped with the same farms where I did the interviews with the workers.
Something you mentioned in your book is that our ideas about farming are often shaped by culture and ideology. So how are these farms represented, and how are they viewed by the consumers who support them?
Well, if you've been to the Hudson Valley, you know how beautiful it is. I mean, it's just stunning scenery. There's a whole school of landscape painters that come out of the region for very good reason. So I think one element of a place like the Hudson Valley is the natural beauty element, and the way we impose the beauty onto some sort of business practice or labor practice. So I think one element is it that you look at these farms and they're so beautiful, right? So that's part of culture. But I think there are several other elements to it. And one ties into this concept of romantic agrarianism, which dates back to the Greeks, but Thomas Jefferson really took advantage. And this idea that agriculture is the most vital industry or, you know, business to get into, that farmers themselves are self-reliant, and that it's by nature a wholesome activity. So I think these are concepts that you don't really need to learn, but they're just sort of passed on to you. I mean, think about even just the basic idea of the books that are tailored for children. So if anybody has a child or has friends who have children, when you go and look at the picture books they have, so many of them take part on farms. And the depictions of farms are very, you know, happy places and happy farmers and happy animals in that regard. So I think that the culture plays a really important role in shaping how we think about farming. And I think this also intersects with the way that local food has been marketed, very much taking advantage of the cultural component. And I think what's happened is the way local has been crafted in terms of when you think about local food, what you're supposed to come to mind is this idea of a mom and pop operation, a very wholesome operation, a natural operation, something that's healthy, good for the land, good for the community, good for the people. And I think that there are plenty of local farms that are doing exactly that. But I think the way that a lot of the food movement writing sets up the conversation is that on one hand, you have these wholesome local farms. And then on the other hand, you have giant corporate big ag monoculture farming, and that one is wholesome and one is evil. And so that we're meant to understand local farming in contradistinction to corporate farming. And that since we know it's so different on many, many levels, I think it's easy for us to assume it's different in terms of the way the workers are treated as well.
And one of the interesting aspects is that there's sort of a moral value that's placed on farm labor in this sort of mythology. What strikes me from your book is that you're sort of interrogating the assumptions about who is doing that labor. Do you have any ideas of sort of like where those assumptions are coming from? And
so I would say for the most part, an immigrant workforce on farms in places like the Hudson Valley is usually a very hidden workforce. So when you are in the Hudson Valley, there are a lot of magazines that you can pick up in coffee shops and, you know, Edible Hudson Valley. And there are a lot of really beautiful, glossy food and agriculture related magazines. And, you know, their stock in trade is to portray the beauty of the farms and the you know, the sort of back to nature new farmers and the rugged farmers who've been doing it for a while. And it's just so rare to see any pictures of workers. And if there are any pictures of workers, it's very much a sort of background picture. They're rarely foregrounded. Edible Hudson Valley, to its credit, did have a spread of farm worker photos in 2013, photos by Robin Romero. So I think, you know, more anecdotally, because this wasn't the heart of my research, but anecdotally, it seems like a lot of people assume that there might not even be labor on the farms that are local farms. And I think that that's not an unreasonable assumption when you read a book like Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma, where he defines two types of farming. You have industrial and you have pastoral. And the farmers he talks to, you know, they're not really mentioning their workers all that much. Even if you look at a film like Food, Inc., some of the depictions of farms there are really focused on the farmers themselves, and workers are very much in the background. So I think one of the aspects here is that it's a very hidden workforce for several reasons. One, that it's often a non-citizen workforce, either undocumented workers or guest workers, and there are language barriers. Sometimes they live on the farm, they don't leave the farm, and many of them are fearful, so they don't want to be in the public eye. Farmers themselves also don't want their workers to be in the public eye for the same reasons. But then I think, not unreasonably, farmers can be very defensive when you ask questions about work and labor. So they just don't want to have that conversation. And I think, you know, for good reason. They know of some expose that took place on a farm the next county over, and they don't want to be part of that.
How did you conduct your research? What was the time span over which you conducted these interviews, and how did you choose your locations? How did you find people?
I started my research in 2000 and did my research for my book project for a little more than a decade. And a lot of my time I spent talking to farm worker advocates, people who were trying to pursue increased labor rights for workers, people working in legal services, so people working in migrant health, for example. So trying to get a picture of the people who serve and advocate for farm workers. So I spent a lot of time trying to understand their perspective. And through that, I met a lot of farm workers who I would have conversations with. But then I didn't want my farm worker interviews to be through those groups. So I independently got in my car and drove around with interns all over the Hudson Valley, just knocking on doors and asking if there are workers here that might be interviewed. So it was a lot of time. And, you know, you need to go in the evening because workers are working long days. So it's tough. They work very long days. They want to come home and they want to make dinner. So I tried to be really as respectful as I possibly could. What was fascinating to me is that almost every farm worker I met said they would be happy to be interviewed and they wanted to tell their story. When it came to interviewing farmers, I started calling up farmers. I'm so honored that the farmers that I interviewed agreed to be interviewed for my book, because more than one hung up the phone on me or had some choice words to say about my wanting to pursue any questions about their workers. So that was really a question of, you know, just keep asking, maybe talking to people at farmers markets. And then that brought up your question about farmers markets. In a place like New York City, you have such a diversity of vendors at these farmers markets. So if it's a really small farm, you may have a farmer coming in themselves 2 or 3 days a week to sell at a handful of markets. But you might have a farm that does 40 markets throughout the state. And so they're usually hiring local people to sell at the farmers market. So it's really difficult to say who that is. I think you have a better chance of meeting actual workers from the farm at a farmer's market that's very local to where the farm is.
Something you mentioned is that historically in the Hudson Valley, there's been an what you call an ethnic shift in the farm worker population. So what do you mean there?
This is something that I found particularly interesting. When we think about farm workers in the U.S., I think a lot of us immediately think about Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, and our assumptions are that about Mexican farm workers. That's very much a West Coast and Midwest labor market that was coming from Mexico for so many decades. And along the East Coast, you had a Black workforce who were either African American or Black Caribbean workers. These were the majority of the farm workers in New York State up until the 1980s. And starting in the 1980s is when you really see a shift from the Black workers to the Latino workers. And I had seen a chart by some Cornell University researchers that really just visualized how the Black workers had declined as a workforce over the course of 20 years, and there was a mirror increase in the Latino workforce. So the way I talk about it as an ethnic shift is because I argue that to some extent this was a conscious decision by farmers to replace their workforce. And part of it has to do with an aging population of African American and Caribbean workers. Part of it has to do with the fact that the newer Latino workers really were the most vulnerable workers and the ones who were willing to work the hardest. So I heard a lot about how the Latino workers had a really strong work ethic compared to the previous workers. And this isn't uncommon that you see an ethnic shift and there's a whole host of ethnic or racial stereotyping around why that shift might have taken place. But it's very much, to go back to that idea of there being a regional labor market. So the shift to a Latino workforce is something that happens when farmers talk to each other and lend a farm worker over here, and then that farm worker brings family and community members up. So the concept of a Mexican farm workforce in New York State is very much a late 20th century phenomenon.
Something you mentioned, too, is that on individual farms, workers of different backgrounds, different racial backgrounds or class backgrounds might have a completely different experience, you know, in terms of their feeling about how they're treated or the working conditions on the farm. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. Yeah, so most of the time, if farm workers were housing workers, you would see highly segregated housing where you would have Jamaican guest workers in one particular area and then Mexican workers in another area. Or you might even see different groups of Latino workers in different areas. And it seemed to me that workers always had the impression that a different ethnic group was doing better, because not only did they have segregated homes, but they also were segregated according to tasks on the farm. So you might hear a worker say something like, oh, they pay that group less and they give them more work as a result. Or they give me trees to go pick from that had already been picked over, so it's much harder to fill up a bucket in a quick amount of time. So I wouldn't say that I heard stories about resentment between groups. I wouldn't be surprised if it was there, but I certainly heard workers on some of the farms talk about how the different groups were treated differently. And I think I only went to one farm where there was actually a large house that had a mixture of Caribbean and Latino workers in it.
You also conducted extensive interviews with the farmers and farm managers themselves. Who are these farmers? You know, can you describe them as a group and maybe as individuals too?
Sure. For the most part, the farmers I interviewed were at least second generation farmers, if not third generation. Two of the farmers I interviewed were coming into farming without having family experience in farming. And those two also happened to be the one that used organic practices. They weren't certified organic, but they used organic practices. The majority of the farms I looked at, it seemed that they had been selling to a wholesale market, or you know, a decade or two earlier, but then the wholesale market was just not making any money. So they had shifted their marketing to more of a local market, trying to target restaurants or do some events on the farm in terms of agrotourism. You know, mostly male, all but one was white, probably the youngest I interviewed was in his mid-30s, but aside from the son of another farmer who was in his late 20s, most of them, I would say, were 45 and above.
So their attitudes about their workers are pretty complex. Can you describe some of the tensions that you noticed in your interviews with the farmers?
Yeah, complex is the perfect word for it. So many of these farmers really recognize that they would not be able to do what they did without their workforce, that they were completely reliant on the people they hired. Many of them talked about wanting to, you know, do right by their workers, that they would talk to immigration lawyers to see if there were opportunities to become legal. They would go online and book airplane tickets if their workers were going back home. There were a fair number of workers who might go home every 3 or 4 years to Latin America. And some of the farmers talked to me about how the farm workers had it bad, right? That so many of them weren't here with their families. They had the immigration issues. It reminded at least one farmer of the immigration issues that, you know, his grandfather or great grandfather had faced. So on the one hand, you have those sort of positive attitudes. On the other hand, I think that there certainly was some tension in terms of really needing to secure a workforce that was not going to complain. So I would hear comparisons about the Latin American workers to the African American or Caribbean workers. And one of the things that came up was some of the farmers said they didn't want their workers to learn English, because once they learned English, then they would start thinking like Americans and they would become a little bit more lazy. The other aspect of it was that some of the farmers knew that wages from his or her farm were building houses and doing indoor plumbing and paying for medical bills and education bills in home countries, and that workers' lives can be really transformed in the home country by the funds they send home, or at least the lives of their families, because a lot of times the workers aren't there. So I think there was also this sense from some of the farmers about doing good, because workers had shown them pictures that they were proud of what they had accomplished. There was, you know, some sense of wanting workers to, you know, work well with each other and work in teams. But then on the other hand, being concerned when workers had solidarity, right? So there was one farmer, I remember him talking about an incident where I think someone drove a tractor into the side of a barn, and he was furious, and none of the workers would tell him who did it. So in a sense, they seemed to be protecting each other, and that was very infuriating to the farmer. I think when you looked at the farmer's attitudes, this comes into ideas around paternalism, and that was some of the complexity of the labor relationship. Because paternalism, on the one hand, is this idea that you're taking care of somebody. But on the other hand, if you're the person who's being taken care of in that sort of relationship, for the most part, you're being taken care of in a way that you can never repay what's being offered to you. And so you often feel extremely indebted. So the paternalism happens outside of the particular labor contract. So for workers, the labor contract really just includes the wages they're making, and maybe the housing arrangement. But then there are all sorts of other, what you might call perks of the job, that you can have family live with you in a trailer, that you can bring home farm produce, that you might be able to use farm trailers, that you can get a loan from the farmer that you're going to pay off. So some of these aspects of the labor relationship that happen outside of the labor contract really seem to fall into a paternalistic mode. And again, on the one hand, there's this sense of the workers being taken care of. But on the other hand, it's very difficult to separate that from labor control, and that paternalism can be an amazing method to control your workers.
How do the farmers sort of think about the needs of the business? How do they justify the conditions when they're admitting that they're not particularly good working conditions on their farm?
Well, I don't know if a farmer would necessarily look at it as having to justify anything at all, right? If you look at the way the law is structured, there's no day of rest for farm workers, according to the law. That's not required. There are no overtime pay required. So I can have workers who are working 7 days a week, 80 hours a week, and it's legal, right? So I think one way to think of it is, I'm just following the law. And, you know, I think we can go back in time and imagine that the law is grounded in some sort of moral code. So I think that's one aspect of it, is that if I'm following the law, then I don't really have anything to justify. I think another way it gets justified, though, is that this is just another immigrant experience, like their grandparents or great-grandparents had, you know, and that when you first come to this country, you have to pay your dues. On the one hand, I can understand that analogy, but I think on the other hand, our immigrants from the past had very different opportunities when it came to becoming citizens. And today, so many are locked out of possibilities for citizenship. So it's not a similar immigrant story. It's a different immigrant story that they're experiencing. But I think probably the greatest aspect that farmers return to again and again is that this is not a business with high profits, and that it's the type of business that has so many variables that farmers are so concerned that a hailstorm next week could destroy their crop, or an early frost, or too much rain, or not enough rain. So there are all sorts of vagaries of the weather that could completely change their opportunity to make money in any given year. And so farmers, the ones I talk to, seem to very much perceive their own livelihoods as very precarious. They also like to say that they're price takers, not price makers, so that they don't have a choice in what they're going to charge for food. That's a really interesting concept, because the sales to local was supposed to be cutting out any sort of middleman, which meant more into the farmer's pocket. But I think perhaps the way food pricing is structured in our country as a whole means that farmers feel a lot of pressure to keep their prices low on their food, that they feel that there's this constant competition. And I also think that the farmers often feel that they work harder than their workers do. Those are a whole bunch of reasons why it might be easier for someone to think, I wish I could offer my workers a better benefits package. I wish I could offer them a vacation days or health insurance, but it's just not possible given the nature of the business. And, you know, nature being in several different meanings there, and that you have an industry where almost no farmers are offering vacation days or health benefits or retirement packages or anything close to that, paid sick days. And so it's part of a larger system of the way farms are managed. And anything that I might do might put me at a competitive disadvantage compared to the farmer down the road who's not extending these benefits to her workers, but is charging the same price for her arugula.
So a lot of this must play out in terms of farmer resistance to increased rights of their workers.
Yes. So New York State has had the Justice for Farm Workers campaign since the late 1990s. And this is an effort to what the advocates call put farm workers on an equal playing field with other workers so that they would have the right to overtime pay. They would have the right to a day of rest. They would have the right to disability protections. They would have a right to collective bargaining protections. And like any other business owner, when farmers hear this, they just see the money flying out of their bank accounts, right? So for farmers, it's not about any sort of moral argument. You know, it doesn't reach that terrain. A lot of the advocates talk about this in terms of a moral argument or an ethical argument. But for farmers, it's often about just the economics of the situation. And I think as well, farmers are really afraid of some sort of exposé that might reveal particular abuses. In my work, I wasn't looking for any sort of exposés or super abuse. I was really trying to say what happens on a typical farm and what are the structural factors that keep farm workers as a vulnerable workforce. And I think that for the most part, my guess is that most farmers are following the law, or at least trying to follow the law, think they're following the law. And while there are plenty of cases of wage theft or other sorts of labor abuse, I think that some farmers just maybe they don't imagine that that happens. So they don't understand why farmer workers would need more protections. And they might argue that there's, you know, those are just the bad apples and the bad apples should be targeted because of the labor abuse they engage in, but things are okay on their farm. But the resistance is very deep. And I think this is part of this is there's another very strong cultural component to this. The fact that agriculture really was the main industry in this country for so many decades upon decades. And what you had throughout the 19th century and into the early 20th century was the formation of interest groups and local groups that were serving farmer interests, so that farmers have long been working collectively and they understand each other's situation, and then they take the positions together in terms of how they feel about legislation. So I actually think if you were a farmer of a good size in New York State, you might not want to come out in support of overtime for workers because you might be perceived as betraying your peers in some regard.
You've been listening to an interview with Margaret Gray, Associate Professor of Political Science at Adelphi University and author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton. Today's show of Out There is a podcast made by John McGee. We'll go back to it in just a minute.
So that attitude that you described seems to typify the Farm Bureau's take on the whole campaign for justice for farm workers. Who are the Farm Bureau and what are their politics today?
The Farm Bureau is a really incredible organization. There's a national Farm Bureau. Each state has a Farm Bureau. Every county in most states have Farm Bureaus. And it's very much a grassroots organization from when you read the literature, because they have meetings of farmers. I'm sure it's the same in Massachusetts as it is in New York. And farmers are in a position to put proposals forth. So every year, the New York Farm Bureau puts out a policy manual. And in that policy manual are, you know, what they would like to see, what they would like to see supported. And maybe there are only a handful of farmers in your state who wanted to see something supported, but that will get represented in the policy handbook. So on one hand, it's a real opportunity for farmers to feel that they have a voice in a greater conversation, because the Farm Bureau then becomes this conduit. There are other farmers who they're members of the Farm Bureau just because that's where they get their insurance from, but they don't feel particularly represented by the Farm Bureau at all. the Farm Bureau position has long been that workers are treated really well on New York farms. They've had panels put together where journalists have written that farm workers get paid more than they do. And, you know, they interview workers who have retirement packages. So the Farm Bureau in general has been really reluctant to want to recognize that there are problems on farms. And part of this really comes down to the fact that workers are afraid to talk about their problems. So I might go onto a farm and interview workers, and what they're telling me that they would like to see changed, they're afraid to tell their boss they might want to see that changed. There are government hotlines that workers can call to complain about problems, and the State Department of Labor will take those concerns seriously. Workers sometimes feel that the process just takes so long that I don't think the Department of Labor gets a lot of phone calls. So then you can look at those statistics and say, but if there were problems on farms, we would be here about them. But probably their most potent argument is these workers come back year after year. How could they possibly not have good situations if they come back year after year? And I think that it's easy to take in that argument and say, well, yeah, that makes sense. Why are they still there? But I think that that very much erases the vulnerability of those workers and the fact that the workers I spoke to feel they have no other choices to make income. No opportunities in their home country. They don't have legal status. They've got a sixth grade education. They've got no training in any sort of craft. Or even if they did, they feel as though the barriers are too high to be a mechanic in the U.S. You can't be a truck driver in the U.S. if you're undocumented. So many of these workers are feeling pretty desperate that agriculture is their only option. And so they do come back year after year because they are very much in need of that money, whatever the money is from the paycheck. And I think that I've also known farms where you might have one really vocal worker who's talking to advocates and talking to the press. And I'll tell you, in one instance, a worker told me that his coworkers approached him, at least 11 of them approached him and said, "Don't talk for me. Don't talk for us. You can go ahead and tell your own story, but don't talk for us." And he told me, he said to them, "You're in the same situation I'm in. We talk about how we're treated on the farm. Why wouldn't you want to make this story known?" And he said that they're just so afraid. They're so afraid of losing a job, which means losing income, losing a home, or the possibility of deportation and the idea that they might not be able to return to the U.S. So yes, workers often return to farms year after year. There are, you know, there are very complex reasons for why they do that. And I don't think it's as straightforward as, well, clearly they love their jobs because they come back year after year. So that's, I think, some of how the Farm Bureau gets summed up. And again, they return to an economic argument and say that any increased benefits for workers that will cost farmers money are going to put farmers out of business. And here's where they can tap into the spirit of sustainability and the spirit of local, because we know that farms are shutting the barn doors every year because they can't survive. And the implications of that could mean the loss of agriculture, the loss of open space, the loss of rural identity. And for those of us who want to see sustainable farming happen, we don't want that to happen. We don't want agriculture to go out of business. So those can be really potent arguments for a public that's not so aware of the situation of workers.
In this campaign in New York State for a minimum wage for farm workers, I'm curious if you could tell us about who the farm worker advocate organizations were and what became of them during and after that campaign.
In the 1990s, there were different groups that joined together to form the Justice for Farm Workers campaign. Probably the most prominent had been Rural and Migrant Ministry, and then an organization called CETA that was a worker center for workers. you also had individuals from organizations like Farm Worker Legal Services, local churches, college students. So different groups of people who came together, and some of them had direct access for workers, or there would be the annual Farm Worker Congress where they would talk to workers about what they wanted. And in the 1990s, the advocates took a piecemeal approach, trying to look at one change in the law at a time. And so one of their first successes was for there to be water, fresh water, drinking water provided in the fields. Now, this was already required if you had a certain number of workers, but if your workers were under a particular threshold, you did not have to provide fresh water. And so advocates were able to change the law, casting this as, you know, look, workers don't have any access. They have to bring their own water. They don't have access to fresh water in the fields. And that tugged at a lot of heartstrings, this idea that they didn't have fresh water. So that law was changed so that all workers had to have access to fresh drinking water. The second law that changed was a sanitation law, meaning that you had to have porta-johns in the field, or you had to be within a certain distance to walk to a latrine with hand washing facilities. And perhaps some of why this came about was more about the public saying, okay, if they're out in the field for how many hours and they don't have a place to relieve themselves, what are the implications of that? And we would rather have them, you know, using proper facilities because that may be affecting the food we eat. The third law that changed was a minimum wage law. And at the time in the 1990s, the farm worker minimum wage was lower than the state minimum wage. And the minimum wage for farm workers was not connected to the minimum wage for the state. I think in reality, what happened was that the market wage was already a little bit higher than the minimum wage was. And so this didn't seem like such a big deal to extend the minimum wage to farm workers. And, you know, then legislators get to say that they did something successful. And I think that, if memory serves me, that the Farm Bureau was also in support of that bill because they didn't think it would have an economic impact since people were already paying, you know, whatever that particular amount was. So after those three laws passed, the advocates would have pretty intense meetings with workers around the state to try to understand, is there a next law you want to be approached? And it was agreed upon that they wanted all the laws to be changed. They wanted farm worker in the New York State Constitution and the labor laws. It, you know, there'll be rights for certain workers, and then it will say except farm workers. So they wanted that except farm workers removed throughout the Constitution and the labor laws for New York State. And the implications would mean then workers would have a right to overtime pay, a day of rest, collective bargaining protections, disability, and a few other laws. And so this then is an omnibus bill, right? That it's got a collection of changes it wants to make. And the farm worker advocates through the Justice for Farm Worker campaign have been at it since 2000. So 15 years later, there's still an annual Farm Worker Advocacy Day, usually in May in Albany, to talk to legislators and have a rally. And the bill is always introduced. The problem in New York State is that while this bill has passed the Assembly pretty much every year that it's been introduced, it doesn't get past the Senate, because the New York State Senate is very much dominated by rural legislators. So there was a moment back back in the last decade where the Democrats did have control of the state Senate for a moment, and they let the bill go to the floor, and it was voted down by a very narrow margin. And it was voted down because a couple of co-sponsors to the bill voted against it, and one of them didn't show up. So, you know, not really sure what happened there, and what kind of decisions got made about that sort of legislation. But every year the legislation gets reintroduced. And I think something that's really important to consider, I was speaking to an assembly, a state assembly woman about 2 weeks ago, and she was talking about farmers and farmers concerned and how crazy the farm labor bill was and how it was going to hurt her farmers. And we didn't get to have an extensive conversation, but I couldn't help think to myself, she doesn't have any constituents who are farm workers, right? They're not voting. They're not donating any money. And so they're really not on the radar themselves of the legislators, except through these advocates. So that's pretty much defining the farm worker movement that's been taking place in New York for the past 20 years.
So when the Farm Bureau does its lobbying against this sort of legislation, what does it look like? And what has it looked like in the recent past?
The New York State Farm Bureau has, I think last time I checked, there were 8 individuals in the Government Affairs Department, which essentially means 8 lobbyists. Now, they have concerns that are much more extensive than just farm labor issues. But they walk the halls of the Legislative Office Building in Albany. They bring legislators on farm tours. They have days when they bring farmers to come talk. And they also do things such as give out awards when legislators have a particular record of voting in line with what the Farm Bureau is interested in. They also put out public materials, right? So they might get some op-eds out there or do some YouTube videos. They did a couple of panels several years ago, and then those, you know, and this was sort of myth versus reality, and the Farm Bureau was telling the reality of what was happening on the farms, their reality, saying that what the advocates were arguing was myth. So there's very much a public aspect to their lobbying, and then also, you know, more nitty-gritty in the halls of the Legislative Office Building.
And you mentioned in that last chapter discussing legislation that some of the farm worker advocate organizations have been defunded and even harassed. Has that come from the Farm Bureau, or does anyone know how exactly that has happened?
The Farm Bureau takes no credit for that. There's been a particular farmer who's been really assertive at wanting to work on behalf of farmers' rights and to try to discredit advocates. And so at times he's used the vehicle of the nonprofit status as an opening to try to say, if they had any sort of federal funding, to try to challenge the funding because maybe they were doing something that could be perceived as lobbying. The other aspect that what happened was, when you think about who made up the Justice for Farm Workers campaign, what organizations were involved, there would be organizations involved on very different levels, and some of them would really come to the table to talk about farm worker concerns, because Justice for Farm Workers wasn't just about passing laws in Albany, but it was about how do we provide better services to farm workers and how do we share information around what we're doing. And so you had organizations like Migrant Health and Migrant Education, who would be at the table at those Justice for Farm Worker meetings, sharing information about how to better serve farm workers. And when they were called to talk to their congresspeople to defend why they were at that table or what they were doing, it had very much of a chilling effect. And some of these organizations left the table altogether. So yes, there were examples of funding being taken away, or a lot of attempts at funding being taken away, but also organizations being afraid of being the target of harassment by a particular grower, so that they just took a big step back.
Okay, so as your book's title suggests, you're interested in more than just exposing poor working conditions. So what is your vision for making a comprehensive food ethic, and how do we get to a place where farm workers are treated with respect?
Well, I use this term comprehensive food ethic because after really immersing myself in food movement literature, so much of it is premised on ideas of sustainability and sustainable livelihoods. And when you think about environmental issues and animal issues, a lot of it comes down to ethics around food. And so, using the language and the arguments of the food movement, I would say that they're proposing a food ethic, and that a food ethic, by definition, needs to include concerns about the workers. So I think some of my recommendations are for those of us interested in farm labor conditions to do what you're doing, right? Try to educate others about what farm worker conditions are. And, you know, don't just take the word of my book, you know, go do your own research and look for the newspaper articles and the other books that are written out there in the, you know, Human Rights Watch reports that are put out, or the Oxfam reports, or the Southern Poverty Law Center, to look at the structure of agriculture in the U.S. and what the conditions of workers are. And a lot of states have local farm worker movements. So the idea of talking to those advocates, trying to talk to farm workers themselves. So I think the first step is really about educating the public. And I don't see this as any different as the way an organic movement has tried to educate the public about the dangers of pesticides, about the way an animal rights movement has tried to educate the public to say, you know, you're putting something in your body that relied on a certain level of suffering, you know, and how do you mitigate the suffering of the animals? And I guess the same question can be said, how do you mitigate the suffering of the workers themselves? So I think a lot of this might be the fact that, you know, the food movement could just have a hierarchy of concerns. I certainly am seeing more attention paid to labor at this point, which is really promising. So I think education. And then I think the other aspect is, if you're someone who cares about farm workers, start having conversations with farmers. When I asked farmers, you know, what kind of questions they would get about their farms from consumers, it was pesticides, 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 right? So many consumers concerned about that. One farmer told me he even designed a handout because he got tired of answering questions. And I said, well, what sort of questions do you get about your labor force? And farmers were really scratching their heads on that one. Nobody had ever asked them a question about their workers. So I think if we are concerned and we would like to buy from farms that were treating their workers in a certain way, that we should be telling farmers that. I think another aspect is to really consider what the laws are. So if your laws in your state are excluding farm workers from certain rights, how do you feel about that? Are you willing to write a letter to your legislator? I think for me, so much of this really comes down to the relationship that workers have on the farm, and that workers don't feel empowered when they have a complaint. They don't feel empowered when there are 4 hours of wages missing from their paycheck to go and say, hey, you didn't pay me for these hours. You know, something as basic as that, getting paid for the hours you worked. And I think it's so important for there to be the beginning of a transformation taking place on the farms. And what workers say is, when you have the law designed in a way that says that farm workers matter less than other workers, that they feel there are implications for how they are then perceived, that they're perceived to be, you know, not worthy in a sense, and that it's okay to treat them poorly. And I think one aspect of changing the law could be that farm workers themselves will feel a lot more empowered about being respected by a government system, and being able to start to shift the relationship on the farm itself.
So let's return to the Farm Bureau line that increased minimum wage for farm workers is going to drive farms out of business, or these other reform bills are going to affect the viability of farms. I guess the question I have is, can we afford better treatment for farm workers?
So I think in so many ways that the farmers I studied in a local food system are on the same side of the equation as the farm workers. I think they're both victims of a corporate food system that has meant that the U.S. has the lowest food prices in, you know, all of the westernized world. And I think that that's really part of the issue, is the U.S. public's dependence on cheap food. And when you think about that 25% of our food, it's estimated, is discarded, right? So I think that there are much larger implications about the need for change. And I think that the local food movement, where farmers are selling directly to workers, that there's a great opportunity here, because you've seen a price premium when it's organic. You've seen a price premium when animals are treated a different way. You know, when you go into a restaurant, you're buying the chicken from a particular named farm, and it feels like you can pay more for it because it's local. So I think that there's opportunity to say, yep, you know what? I'm charging you 5 cents a pound more, but that 5 cents is being passed directly on to the workers. There are no numbers for local agriculture, but when you think about tomatoes, if we raise the wages of workers in tomatoes, I'm thinking about Eric Schlosser, and he argues that the average household would see about a 44 cent increase in their tomatoes over the course of a year. There's an agricultural economist at UC Davis who said that raising workers' wages significantly could cost as little as $15 a year overall for consumers. So I think it's really a matter of trying to get any sort of price increase passed directly onto workers. And that's very difficult for farmers when they see the cost of gas raising, and there's another tractor that has to be repaired, and there are these other issues that need to be taken care of, and they feel like they don't have a lot of incentive to pay their workers more. So I think there's promise in a local food movement for us to say, oh, I hear the farmer over here is paying this, and when you're willing to do that, I'll buy from you also. But I think it's a long road that we're on to get there.
Margaret Gray is Associate Professor of Political Science at Adelphi University. Her book, Labor and the Locavore, is out from UC Press in 2014. Margaret, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Was a podcast made by John McGee. You can go to his website at liberationagriculture.org. It's a work in progress. You've been listening to Out There. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock.